Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Michelle Singletary arrived at the Washington Post in the early 90s at the age of 29, a young hire for the business section. She had 8 years of experience already under her belt, a strong journalistic track record at the Baltimore Evening Sun. But her new colleagues at the Post were skeptical. They questioned her credentials. And it got to the point where Michelle one day confronted her boss, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a white man. And Michelle, what did you ask him?
I simply asked him, did you hire me because I'm Black?
And how did he respond?
He said, yes, I hired you because you were Black.
Was that the complete be-all and the full answer?
That was the full answer in that moment. And he could see my face and my eyes started to tear, and he said, come into my office, let's talk. And so he guided me into his office, and he set me on the couch, and he pulled his chair over in front of the couch. And he said some things, and I didn't hear him because all I was thinking is, so they were right. I don't deserve to be here. And then finally, I tuned into what he was saying, and he said, but I also hired you because you come from a low-income background and you bring a perspective that we don't have in the section because of that. You are getting your master's degree. You tell wonderful stories about your grandmother and money management. And most importantly, you have an expertise in covering bankruptcy, which I had gained working for the Evening Sun. And he just ran through this long list of things of, you know, why he hired me. You're a good reporter. You know, you're just, as I was tuning into those things, and he finally said, you know, I hired you because of the totality of who you are. Mm-hmm. And your being Black is an asset to the Post. And I thought, wow, I had never thought about that, because you often run away from that. If you're a woman, you don't want someone to think you're the woman hire, you know, but there is an advantage to that. There's, our experiences are different from men. Being Black is different when you grow up in different neighborhoods. And he was saying, I am not ashamed or embarrassed to say that, yes, that played a factor in my hiring you. And there is nothing wrong with that.
Now, this is David Weiss, right?
That's David Weiss, yeah.
And he said he wanted to also mentor you as you rose in your journalism career.
Yeah, I was doing great at the Evening Sun. I had a wonderful editor. Her name is Patricia Fanning. She was the editor of the business section. She actually recruited me for the business section. But the Sun was going through a lot of transition and eventually was sold. And I just felt like I wasn't going to be able to do what I wanted to do. And he was like, you know, you got a great path here at the Post and I want to help you. And I see great things for you. And he saw things that I didn't even see for myself. And I'll never forget that. I mean, I'm just tearing up already. People have listened to other programs. Why is she always crying? But, you know, you feel these things so deeply. And I never told that story, except for a couple times in a few speeches, because you just don't want to people to think that you have that kind of self-doubt, but you still carry it. And even to this day, I have some of that doubt. Every once in a while, I go, do I deserve to be here? And I think back to that conversation to David Weiss, and I say, yes, I do deserve to be here. I am good at what I do. And it's okay to say I am a Black columnist for the Washington Post.
Yes. Yes, it is. You are extraordinary in what you do, Michelle. So, I mean, yes. Yeah, so our frequent listeners will... They'll know you from your work in the Post, from your nationally syndicated column as well, and from the many times we've been lucky enough to have you on this show. And we're talking to you today because of this truly remarkable 10-part series that is coming in the Washington Post called Sincerely Michelle, where you are getting personal about some pretty profound misconceptions about race that persist in this country to this day. We've got links to the first couple of parts of Michelle's series at onpointradio.org. You know, there's one that's the story that you open the series with, which is this story in particular about when you asked David Weiss if he had hired you because you're black. It's so powerful. And then and there's something, though, that I want to hear. I want to hear a little bit more from about more from you about. Because he then takes you into his office, as you said, and explains the totality, right, of why he hired you. But, I mean, what the implication is that your colleagues who were talking about you being being hired just because you were black, they did not see that totality. Is that right?
Some of them, not all of them. You know, I loved working in the business section. It was a very nice place to work. But there were some individuals who said things behind my back, and it got to me, that they just hired me because I was black, that they have these orders to hire black people. And, you know, with the really what they're saying is I took a job from a white person. And some people who sort of came to my defense, you know, would tell me what they were saying. And some said things right to my face. There was a colleague who basically, I don't know, we may have been talking about affirmative action. And he said, you know, at some point, white men in the newsroom are going to be endangered species. And I just thought, are you serious, dude? And I said to him, and I can't even believe I actually said this, but sometimes when I get mad, I get quite sassy. So I said, stand up and look around. How many, you know, do you see a shortage of white guys around here? And his face turned red. And, you know, I said, I don't mean to insult you, but the fact of the matter is that is not happening, that there's still not a representation of African Americans or blacks in our newsroom and in many corporations in this country. And so you're saying that is racist. I didn't say that to him, but it was.
Well, you write about how there's a price to pay, as you put it, when you're the so-called black hire. How do you feel? What price is that, and how did you have to pay it?
When you walk in the door, there is the assumption that you are the quote unquote black hire and that you have to prove yourself worthy before they will believe that you were hired for your qualifications, that everything being equal, you excelled among the other candidates. And that unless you are an extraordinary, superhuman employee, then you didn't deserve to be there. You took a job from somebody else because you're black. And you know that, you know, going into that door. And that's such an incredible way. You can't fail. You can't stumble because it would confirm to them that you don't deserve to be there.
Mm. So you write about how you were on a scholarship through the Sun to the University of Maryland, it was called the Black Sun Scholars. Is that right?
Right. So the community in Baltimore was quite upset with the coverage in the Baltimore Sun of their community, as many communities are now. And to their credit, the leaders of the Baltimore Sun created a minority journalism scholarship. It was an application open to all minorities throughout the state, black, Asian minorities. And you had to apply based on your grades and things. You got a scholarship. So I won the first scholarship, and we became, and there were many more after us, about eight of us after us. It was one scholarship per year. It was an amazing scholarship. 4 years of tuition, room, and board at the University of Maryland, College Park, plus a stipend for books, plus a summer internship for all 4 years of college, a paid internship, mind you. And me being me, I turned it into even more. During breaks, I asked them if I could come work in the newsroom on weekends and doing cops, and they agreed and paid me for that as well. So I kind of added that little bonus in there. So it was just an extraordinary scholarship. And so after a couple of us went there, we became known as the quote unquote Black scholars, Black Sun scholars, which didn't offend any of us. It was great. Except there were some people, and this is more on the Baltimore Sun side, who again would say things like we got there just because we were Black. We weren't as good as the white summer interns. I had one editor in particular who was just brutal. And she would just send me into the bathroom in tears. Just her treatment was so unfair compared to the other white interns. And one day I was sitting, we had these big desks with these huge partitions, so you couldn't see the person on the other side. And I was sitting at my desk, you know, doing some work one summer, and there were two reporters on the other side talking about the Black Sun scholars. And they were just, it's just not fair. They just take these jobs and they're just here because they're Black, and we need to make sure that we get qualified people. And they didn't know I was sitting on the other side of that partition. I didn't say anything. I just listened. And it was pretty hard to hear that, you know, all the work that I had done, I'd been a great student. I, at that point, had been at Maryland and on the student newspaper. I, you know, had great grades. I mean, I was proving myself. And still, it wasn't enough.
It's... You carry this with you to this day, Michelle.
You do. And part of the reason why I wanted to write the series is because we in this country think slavery was so long ago, it doesn't have any impact on anything right now. But the legacy that left, that we are less than, is still present today, even among people who consider themselves liberal or very open-minded, carry these things. And they don't understand that they are racist.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. It'll be about a minute long, Michelle, so there's a lot more we have to talk about when we come back. We are talking this hour with Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist, nationally syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, about her remarkable new series called Sincerely Michelle, where she gets personal about misconceptions about race in this country. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking with the marvelous Michelle Singletary. Yes, you know her work as the personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, nationally syndicated. She is writing a 10-part series right now, appearing in The Post, called Sincerely Michelle, where she gets personal about deep, insidious misconceptions about race that are still in this country, even in the year 2020. And we've got links to the series at onpointradio.org. And, you know, Michelle, I just have to say one thing about radio is I am always so deeply in awe and feel a sense of gratitude to people who come on this show and are willing to be vulnerable live and in real time, because writing is hard, and you do it day in and day out. But then talking about these things to the country, I just want to say thank you.
You're welcome
for being willing to do this.
Yeah, it's really hard because when you get to a certain point in your career in your life, you don't want to dig this deep because you've overcome so much and you don't want people to feel like, you know, you're so worried and concerned that they'll say you're too racially sensitive, that you're misconstruing what people are saying, that's not what they meant. And at some point you have to say that is what they meant. And whether you meant it or not, this is the effect that it has on me, my children, excuse me. And this legacy of slavery is still haunting our country. Mm-hmm. And until we acknowledge that, we can't get past the wealth gap, for example, in this country.
Yeah. So I'm going to say something that hopefully puts a little smile on your face, okay, Michelle? Because, you know, we've had you on three times over the course of the pandemic thus far with Rana Faruhar, right, from the Financial Times.
Yeah.
And every time we have the two of you on, we get more email from listeners than
wow.
This is not a joke. More email from listeners than just about any other show that we do. And people are like, we love them. Bring them back. I think to this day, I get an email once a week from someone or a tweet from someone who says, when are you going to have the economy ladies back on the show?
So, like, oh, that's wonderful.
We want to create a hashtag like On Point Economy Ladies or the Money Ladies as well. So people, you're really touching a profound nerve. In sharing your analysis and these stories as well, you and Rana. And I just, I mean, come back every week if we could have you on.
But I would love to.
People are your fans. You've got fans. I just want you to know. You've got super fans out there. But I want to play a moment, if I could, from when we had you and Rana on June 15th this summer. Because it was raw and real. And this was just, in the weeks after the killing of George Floyd. And the hour, again, was about sort of a check-in on the economy. There was everything else going on in this country at the same time. And here's what you said.
We want to forget that in our lifetimes, there were so many laws on the books that prevented us from owning businesses and homes and getting jobs. And slavery wasn't just 400 years ago. Those policies that kept a knee on our neck economically still exist.
So that was in the middle of June. Was it around that time as well? I mean, because of the protests and what had happened that you decided you wanted to do this big series in the Post?
You're absolutely right. It was definitely, I started to think about it at that time because, can I just be honest, even to get to a point where you sometimes stay silent because to speak out hurts so bad. And so because I'm a working journalist, I can't go to the marches, you know, there are things that you can't necessarily do. And I'd just been kind of plodding along in my life, just trying to show and prove that I'm worthy by the work that I do. And then when George Floyd was killed and then John Lewis passed away, I just thought, you know what, I can't stay silent any longer. I can't let just my work speak for myself. I have to speak for myself and for so many others who don't have a voice. I made it, no question about it. But there's so many others who haven't. And oftentimes, those of us who have made it or are successful with careers and, you know, money and families, we are referred to as, you know, oh, well, you did it, so why can't they? Mm-hmm. And you're sort of the model minority. And yet you understand why they can't. There were things that happened along my life, people who lifted me up that others didn't have that. That scholarship lifted me up. There were people in that newsroom who lifted me up, who didn't talk about me behind my back as being unworthy, but that helped me become a better reporter and writer.
And so I wanted to speak for those people who don't have a David Vice or a Patricia Fanny or Wiley Hall, who was an African-American columnist who I so admired. And I loved his writing. And so these series of columns are just to say, listen, we value education, because you'll hear people say, well, Blacks will be doing much better financially if they just valued education like other minorities. We absolutely value education. We had to create whole institutions to learn. Historically, Black colleges came out of the fact that we couldn't go to white colleges. You know, we had to create our own banks because you wouldn't lend us money to buy our homes. And so there's so many people who couldn't break that cycle that was created because of slavery. And so even though you can look at those who have broken that cycle, there are so many more who can't. And because there are still things going on that keep their knee on their neck.
Well, so I want to come back to education in a few minutes, if I can, because I want to talk about your grandmother in a couple of minutes. But, you know, you talked about loans and wealth, the wealth gap. You had a recent column about racial disparities in home ownership that you wrote during the pandemic. And I imagine that you get a ton of responses every time you write anything, right? And I understand that at least one reader commented, let's get past blaming things on race and look at education, like you just said, rise above blaming others or a system or whatever, and take responsibility for our actions and commit to being educated. So first of all, when that kind of email lands in your inbox and you click, how do you first feel when you see those words?
You know, I hold my head down. And I breathe. Sometimes I yell, and I'm going to be honest, sometimes I cuss. Please don't tell my pastor. And then it just creates a resolve in me to prove them wrong and to write more about why you're wrong. When following that first column, I got an email from a white male executive at a large corporation. And he said some things that you would think, okay, this is 2020. Are you really serious? And
he said things like what?
He said he went through a litany of reasons why he has been made to hire Black people. And he said there's resentment by other highly qualified employees who should have received that promotion, what creates job turnover. He said when you hire Blacks, that's a drain on productivity and morale. He said it's a stress on management. I'm reading his email. A stress on management. It is very difficult to performance manage a minority employee. It is much easier to performance manage a white employee. He said today minorities, Black, Hispanic, Chinese, Asian do have a real advantage and should recognize. And I thought, wow, really? And so then I wrote him back and I said, you know, listen, this is much like when you're looking for someone for your football team, right? And there's an imbalance. You've got a great quarterback, but you need a defensive line to defend him. And you don't need another quarterback. And you search for folks that will protect him on the line. That's diversity. Filling the team out with what you need and should have to win. And I went through a whole reasons why his logic that, you know, somehow Blacks were harder to manage or that we were taking a job from someone else. I mean, this is a manager at a corporation in 2020 saying things like that.
I'm not going to ask you to get inside his head, but I just wonder, what does it even mean that it's harder to performance manage people of color? Yeah. I don't even understand I don't understand what that means.
You know, and I did. And I wrote him back and I said, OK, this whole idea that somehow because of diversity goals or quotas that Black unqualified candidates are getting in. And I said, I've never seen a corporate diversity policy that said just hire any Black that comes through the door. Just grab somebody off the street. You know, and if you're not hiring well-qualified folks, whose fault is that?
It is the fault of management. I mean, you know, we just recently, the CEO of Wells Fargo had to apologize because he said something like, there's not enough talented Black, you know, people out there. This is 2020, and a major CEO is saying things like this. And you can find qualified candidates if you look. They are out there. I am out here, you know, and I said, you know, this whole idea that you can't manage one. And I think what he meant was they don't feel comfortable. They're afraid, maybe. And isn't that what they used to tell women? And they won't feel comfortable having women. And that's because you feel comfortable with the people who are similar to you. You go out drinking with them or you socialize with their family. But you got to press past that and welcome into your world different people. And it's okay that we're different, but we are still the same in the sense of we want this company to succeed. And so I wrote this all back to him, and he finally said, you know, you're right. I can't believe, you know, that I thought that way. And so that's why we have to have this conversation.
Mm. Does it give you a little bit of hope that, I mean, so I, first of all, I was just going to say, does it give you hope that all it took was one email from you and at least there was an admission or a falling of scales from his eyes? But then I was going to think that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to change his management practice.
Yeah,
overnight.
No, he said, it's so funny you say that because you said you are right reading his email because I was preparing for this interview. And he said, you are right on many of your responses. He said, but when you get a chance, try to interview any senior executive of a large corporation and ask them about their corporate diversity hiring program. Promotion goals, they do exist. And he went on to say again that we are underrepresented because we don't get college degrees, we're not educated. And then he ended with this, at least we can agree to disagree without violence.
And, wow.
Right, exactly. And so I wrote back because this, I'm a crazy person. Sometimes I get into these email debates and I said, finally, violence is the tool of those who feel they have no voice. That was never the case with this conversation. To say so is, well, insulting, although I didn't think you meant to offend. I normally, before the series, would have let that last line go because he did agree that some of the points he had were racist. And then he sort of summed it up by insulting me again with this idea that we, and I know he probably wrote it in tongue in cheek, but given the situation that's going on right now, it wasn't funny. Mm-mm. And I needed to let him know that I didn't think that it was funny.
Okay. Sorry, that one caught me off guard, Michelle, to be perfectly honest, because you're right. Given the situation right now in this country, I guess this goes to show. It's just another one of those shocking examples about how actually a kind of extreme view is remarkably close to the surface. And we just kind of choose to either not see it or turn away. But we can't do that anymore.
We cannot. And these aren't evil people. There are evil racists, clearly. But I think the vast majority of people are holding these viewpoints and they don't even realize how racist is, which is why we need to have these candid conversations. And as you can see, it took a back and forth before I could get him to see what he was saying was wrong. I cannot tell you how many emails I've gotten from people when I wrote that story about affirmative action who said the manager who I was interviewing said I couldn't be hired because they were being made to hire a Black person. Now, first of all, why would you even tell a job candidate that? And then I put it on the job candidate. How do you know that that's actually true? Could it be that he just didn't want to hire, he or she didn't want to hire you? Why is it that your default is, yeah, it's those Black people's fault that I didn't get that job? And so many people are being told that. One of my friends said that to me, and I love this woman. And she said, well, yeah, the editor told me that they needed to hire a Black person. And I said to her again, look around. This newsroom is not full of all Black people. He said that to you incorrectly. Let's challenge that statement as opposed to the fact that they're hiring people just because they're Black.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am going to play a little bit of tape here because we did ask On Point listeners about what they think about these misconceptions. And we got a call from a listener named Doug in Southern California. And he says he's experienced reverse discrimination. He's white. And where he lives, he and his wife bought their first home in a predominantly Hispanic area. And he says this is what happened when they applied for a grant for first-time home buyers.
We didn't make enough money to be disqualified. And so I went into the application process. And right away, you can tell that it was not designed for English speakers. Every sign that was in the place was in Spanish. And so after the application was done and originally approved, they called me up and said, this type of grant isn't designed for people like you. And so we got denied what I believe was solely on our skin color because we passed every calculator or test that they had originally given to us. And so I think I'm just a product of reverse discrimination, unfortunately, and so my hope is that we can all learn from this and in the future treat people equally regardless of their skin color.
So that's On Point listener Doug. And Michelle, we've just got about a minute before we have to take another break here, but what would you say to him?
I would apologize because I understand how he feels that he was discriminated against, but he was not. That program was designed to equalize things that have been unequal for a very long time. And I think we need to accept the fact that we do need to have programs that are targeted to help correct past discrimination.
Okay, so hold that thought because later in the show, I'm going to circle back around to the solutions that you see that we need to take as a nation moving forward to really vanquish these misconceptions that you're talking about in your series, Michelle. So hang on. We're talking this hour with Michelle Singletary, and we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, since it's Friday, we're going to be trying to make sense of the week's news. And of course, the biggest story of the week being the hospitalization over the weekend of President Donald Trump and the White House coronavirus cluster. We'll be following the thread of that story and how it evolved all week long. And so we want to know when the president made that video telling people not to let COVID dominate you. How did you respond to that? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And that's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist and nationally syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. She's got a 10-part series out, coming out week by week now, called Sincerely Michelle, where she gets very personal about misconceptions involving race. And we've got a link to the series at onpointradio.org. And Michelle, before we get back to all the stories you have to tell, there's a story that we want to share with you and our listeners, because you were talking about influences in your life and people that held you up in the last segment. Well, we also spoke this week with Chicago-based editor Adrienne Samuels Gibbs about her grandmother, Cozy Etta Bryant, who Adrienne grew up with, and she used to call Cozy Medea, or short for Mother Dear. And Cozy was 94 when she died last month. She's one of the 212,000 American deaths due to COVID. And while Cozy never received a high school education herself, she ensured that her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren all had the gift of enough money for their college educations. And so we reached out to Adrian, and she told us more of Cozy's story.
She started out in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, a sharecropper's daughter at the age of 4, picking cotton, you know, piss, dirt, poor, and Black, and a little girl. And then she was a part of the Great Migration. She got on a boxcar train in 1944 or so with 3 children under the age of 4 and a lap baby that was still breastfeeding in the middle of the Jim Crow South, packing all their lunches, sat in the Black part of the train, and got all the way from Arkansas to Chicago to meet up with her husband. She did all that. And, you know, I have 2 children right now under the age of 7, and I can't imagine going anywhere with them by myself and having to worry about getting strung up by white people at the same time. Every step of her way was just living history. They were one of the first Black people to buy a house in a neighborhood called Arbon Gresham on the south side of Chicago. When they moved in, it was all white. And I've been told this story many times, how people threatened them. And how people threatened my aunts and uncles. And just what they had to go through just to live is absolutely incredible. But they made it. She was a lunch lady. She cooked because she could cook and she could really cook. And all the kids loved her. She became a foster mother. Even after having all these children, she kept children. And so my grandmother's house was kind of like everybody would be in there. There would always be cakes. There would always be cookies. There would always be donuts. And she made homemade ice cream because, you know, that's what grandmas do. I am marveling at how someone like my Madea was able to accomplish everything she accomplished with not even, you know, an 8th grade education. Though she never became rich by any popular definition of the term, she still set aside money for all of us so that we could have a little book money, baby, or have a little class money, baby, or whatever have you. It was just her pride and joy that we were all smart. It was her pride and joy that we were all successful. And it actually didn't matter whether you went to college or not. That wasn't exactly it. She was just happy that we were successful and we had the choice to do what we wanted to do and not have to do what someone told us to do. She went through all this, all that, lived through breast cancer, lived through all manner of awful things that she wouldn't even talk about anymore, to be felled by COVID-19. It was heartbreaking and I think largely unnecessary. But her legacy is here. It's me and my kids. I can't erase the fact or dissect or remove the fact that we're Black. We're Black. And a lot of what's happening is because we're Black. She lives in a Black neighborhood that was divested by the city of Chicago. She lives in a Black neighborhood that doesn't really have fresh groceries. She lives in a Black neighborhood that has a gang problem, that has a police problem. And so not just COVID, but I wonder if we didn't have the structural inequities that led to bad water, bad air, food deserts, diabetes, and difficult access to medical care that is not influenced by racism. How much longer could she have lived? That is my life's work. And she came up here to have a better life, and we have got to make it better. We are not done.
Adrian Samuels Gibbs, Chicago-based editor for Medium, Zora Magazine, and Momentum. Her grandmother, Cozy Etta Bryant, died last month at the age of 94 from COVID-19. So, Michelle, you had a Cozy in your life too, right?
I did.
Yeah, my grandmother, Big Mom. We called her Big Mama, which is funny, because she wasn't a big woman at all. But she was. She had such a magnanimous personality and presence. And she sounds just like her grandmother. My grandmother took us in. It was five of us. My sister was eight. I was four. I had a sister was three. And twin brothers just under two. And she raised us and she saved and she was fierce about not overspending and paying her home off before she retired. And all of this was just a high school education. And everything I know about money, I learned from Big Mama.
Yeah. And everything you learned about money, because if I have this right, she while she was very frugal and a saver, I mean, you talk a lot about the stock market these days in your column. And I didn't think she was like throwing her money at the market, right?
She wasn't. When I make that statement, I mean that all the basic things that I know about money, I learned from her. Mm-hmm. You know, how to save, how to live below your means, you know, how to just make sure you understand whatever, you know, contract people are putting in front of you. You know, she was, you know, looking over things. But you're right. The second part in the series, not the second part, but actually the third part that's coming up, is on investing. But what my grandmother taught me about investing was to fear it. And in that column, I talk about where that fear came from. She saved like I don't know what, but she could not take that next step to invest other than buying a home because she just couldn't stomach that risk that the market brings. And she passed that fear on to me. And in my 30s and early, my 20s and early 30s, when I was investing in my company's 401k, I was extremely conservative, just bonds and, you know, not really putting the max in because I just didn't want to lose my principal. And I learned that from my grandmother, even though she was an amazing money manager. And so part three of the series talks about how I overcame that fear and why she was so fearful. Because again, what I've been trying to do in this series is dispel all these myths and misconceptions. We don't value education. If we just handled our money better, you know, we would be, you know, better off without recognizing all the things that were in play that kept people back. I loved what Gibb says, which she said, we are not done. And that's what this series is about. So yes, my grandmother was the best money manager I had, but because of all the things that happened to her, you know, slavery, you know, denying loans, not letting you live where you wanted to live, you know, lots of blacks didn't want to take risk. So they might just keep their money in the coffee can in the closet because you know what? The bankers and people did take their property. They did take their money. But we are getting to the, you know, we have to get to the point where we can overcome that fears. And it takes a combination of things, not just your sheer willpower. I can't will myself not to be afraid when I was taught to be afraid by a woman whose grandfather was a slave. That's deep, right? And so, but things were put into place to help me. For example, my first financial planner was a Black woman who understood that fear and helped me overcome it to invest. And now my husband and I invest. We're great. We sent all three of our kids to college debt-free because money that we invested in a 529 plan. But it took that investment company to make the commitment to hire Black financial planner who talked to me and understood my background, my legacy, to say, okay, we went through this. Now you got to push through that, Michelle, so that you can invest and make your money grow. And that's what I've done. And now my children don't have to be fearful investors.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, there's a question I want to ask you. And that is, the very fact that you're writing about these misconceptions and confronting them begins with this, with the idea that these are misconceptions, right? And the reason why I point that out is because I know there are listeners out there right now who are thinking, and you know, probably white listeners who are thinking, well, once again, here we are being told that we're just because what we think that we're racist and that you know, belief in meritocracy is racist and this, that, and the other. So what would you say to them? Because perhaps there's the fact that you had to write this means the misconceptions exist. But also in 2020, I think people will resist the idea that they are misconceptions, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. You know, I actually am writing this for the Dougs because I want to go back to his story because sure. I think people will hear that and say, yeah, look at what happened to him. And I would love that we had a system where everybody could get, you know, money and leg ups, but the pot of money isn't that big. So if we have dedicated funds, who should we help? We don't have people saying, well, we should give, and God help us if we talk about reparations, but let's just go there for a moment. How about the fact that you had this country had, you know, decades of free labor from people who couldn't benefit from their own labor. And so now you have a housing program or I benefited from a first-time home program dedicated to helping me own a home. Why is that not fair? It is fair. And I think that's what we have to address. You know, these misconceptions are deeply rooted in our history and of disenfranchising folks. And so we've got to put our money on the line. We've got to make the schools better. We talk about gangs. Why is there gangs? Well, because where are the centers for them to play ball, to divert them from these actions on the street? You know, pre-daycare, pre-kindergarten classes have been cut. You know, I mean, you house all these people in these small neighborhoods where you can't get jobs. There are no decent food. You build homes that have lead in there. So these children are suffering from lead poisoning. You know, you can't get the health care that you need. Why are we predisposed to diabetes? Let's go there. Yeah. What were we fed as slaves? And so you can't talk about these things without putting them into context. But we don't want to talk about that context, because to talk about that context means that some people were done wrong and you don't want to admit that. Yeah, you might not have been a slave owner, but your ancestors benefited from that system. And you can go to the schools, you can buy the homes that you want because of a system that disenfranchised people. So you have to admit that maybe you personally didn't do it, but you benefited from it. This country benefited. The wealth in this country benefited from the backs of people who had no rights, who were beaten down and hung on a tree.
Michelle, you know, I think it is exceedingly hard to change a person's opinions or beliefs. And sometimes it's not even worth trying.
Yeah.
But we can change policies. We can change systems. And then maybe over time, that different environment that's created by those different policies and systems are the things that lead to a change in belief and opinion. And values, even.
Right.
And do you buy that? Because if you do, then where would you focus our efforts so that in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, because I'm not going to pretend it's going to happen overnight,
yeah.
But where would you focus your efforts so that you don't have to write columns about the racist misconceptions anymore?
I think you're so on point, which is why I love you. You're so great at this. Yeah, it's got to be about policy, corporate and governmental policies. So one of the columns I'm going to be writing soon is about credit scoring and how that disenfranchises Blacks. So let's just start with corporate policy. I've gotten emails from hiring managers that said, thank you for giving me the words to have my managers buy into why diversity matters. And so that's how you begin, with one hiring manager. If I could get one hiring manager not to say to a job candidate, I didn't hire you because I had to hire a Black person, that's progress. Because then that person won't then, once they get on a job, feel some kind of way about a Black person on a job thinking, well, yeah, you got there because you were Black. Because back here, I lost a job because they had to hire a Black person. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that changes that person's attitude. And they don't go behind my back telling me that I don't deserve to be at the Washington Post. It starts in those kind of policies. So if I can get one hiring manager, if we could get a governmental program and get policies in place that gets rid of, you know, credit scoring discrimination and housing discrimination, then attitudes will change. And it is going to take one person at a time, one policy at a time.
Michelle Singletary, Her series is Sincerely Michelle in the Washington Post, where she's a personal finance columnist and a syndicated columnist as well, and a frequent guest that we are privileged to have here on this program. Michelle, thank you so much again.
Thank you so very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.